Mike and Oscar rolling right along with another Oscar Sprint episode, taking you back to a time when news wasn't so fake and everything was real. Our government had our best interests at heart. They were looking out for us. You could just trust the man next to you.
Roger Stone was behind the man behind the man.
This place has always sucked. We're doing the post. Oscar Sprint Profile. I'm your host, Mike. This is my co-host, also Mike.
I am also Mike.
And like I said, we're doing the Steven Spielberg, getting Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep and putting them together, and movie fans and people that just like nice people in general go wild.
Weird wigs. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, you have a problem with the aesthetics of some of these wigs. Costumes. That's all right. So we're doing the post today. The Steven Spielberg movie is going to be heard on Oscar Sunday, at least in contention for nominations. Whether it wins or not, we're going to get into the odds of that coming up. But
it's fallen off a little bit. I will say that looking at last month's Gold Derby, this week's Gold Derby, it's a little different.
It's kind of becoming that movie that's like the filler for all the major categories. The one that'll have like six or seven nominations but no wins.
There was no time for a backlash. Now it's getting a little bit of a backlash now that it's released to the public.
Yeah, well, can't imagine why.
But it was packed screening houses for me.
Was
and,
it?
That's what I call the movie, screening houses. No, but it was packed. Two out of the three nights, rousing round of applause at the end. I had guys behind me just, you know, giving me the play-by-play of what they thought throughout the movie. Maybe we should have him as a guest on our podcast.
Well, at least you didn't ruin your viewing experience.
I'm lucky it was the third viewing.
Goddamn Nixon!
The third in 3 days.
Yeah, so let's go. No, we usually start with the production profile. We're going to hop right into this movie. Instead of doing the production profile to start, Mike wants to get us started on some cast and crew notes, so let's do it.
Yes, I'm going to save the full biographies for other podcasts on Hanks and Spielberg. We already did a full biofilmography of Meryl Streep.
And yes, it did take us 3 days to get through.
It was so good.
Expect.
Yeah.
Back to our 1987 Best Actress. I think it was the first episode. That's a two-parter. The first episode is where we covered Meryl Streep.
It hurts so good.
Maybe the second. I might have just lied to you, but I'm good for that.
So I'm basically going to look at the big names, the last 10 years of their filmographies, and I'll kind of give, you know, more career-spanning arcs for the rest of the big names. So this is going to take a little bit, but there's some big freaking names in this one.
Yes.
Starting out with the small names. Here we go. The post was written by first-time screenwriter Liz Hannah. Veteran Josh Singer came along. He is the writer of Spotlight. He came from TV, where he wrote episodes for The West Wing, Lie to Me, and Fringe, amongst others.
This had a very Spotlight feel in sections. You could see that influence.
Yes, directed by little-known independent filmmaker Steven Spielberg.
I got a good feeling about that kid.
He's
good.
He's good. Spielberg's filmmaking operation is a well-oiled machine right now. He is the head CEO, the head Pumbaa, the grand Pumbaa, one might say, if they spoke correctly.
What is a Pumbaa exactly?
P-U-M-B-A-H. I don't know. I want to be called the grand Pumbaa someday.
Backwards, that's Humup.
I think you should call me Pumbaa.
Mike, and
we have been recording a lot recently.
Mike,
we're a little
Oscar
punchy. Mike, Pumbaa, and Oscar. Yes. His last 10 years, Steven Spielberg, included highs and lows here: Indiana Jones and the Island of the Crystal Skull,
Gay.
The Adventures of Tintin,
yeah.
War Horse,
Gay.
Lincoln, Bridge of Spies, The Big Fucking Giant, BFG. I thought that was going to get a bitter laugh from you. You like acronym swearing humor, don't
I'm
you?
I'm still debating how I felt about it.
Ready Player One will be released in 2018. Great book. I'm so upset that it's going to...
It
looks crappy.
Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah,
maybe,
Oh, it looks awful. The trailers look awful. It looks like nonsense.
It's not
cartoon.
Getting a lot of love online either.
Yeah, it should get like Best Animated Film. I don't know what they're doing here. Anyway, he has an untitled Indiana Jones project that's been announced for 2020.
Indiana Jones, and we're going to kill Harrison Ford in this one?
Yes. Spielberg's been nominated for 13 Oscars, winning 3, 13 Golden Globes, or Golden Globes,
Either
as
one.
I like to say it.
They're
winning,
both very prominent.
Winning 3 as well. That's that little known indie spirit guy.
I think he's got a future in this business.
Meryl Streep is the protagonist of the film. She plays Kay Graham, the
publisher. Her I'm not so sold on.
Right, the publisher of the Washington Post. Streep's last 10 years includes a bunch of little-known films as well. Mamma Mia, Doubt, Julie and Julia, It's Complicated, The Iron Lady, Hope Springs, August, Osage County, written by Tracy Letts, by the way, Into the Woods, Florence Foster Jenkins, and she's set to star in Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, and Mary Poppins Returns in 2018.
She is going to be in the Mamma Mia sequel?
She's going to be in the Mamma Mia sequel.
I wonder if that's a spoiler you just gave away, because she wasn't in the first preview that came out.
Said IMDb.
Said that she her part was basically taken over by Cher.
Oh, really?
Which is ironic, because that's how the 1987
Look
Best Actress
category
went. Look
at my face and see how much I care.
Here I go again, mama. It's the third consecutive episode.
We referenced ABBA. I guess we got to get into them at some point. But no, listen, I'm way too much.
Get into them.
Mayon.
Got a giant poster of them.
I'm sorry. I draw the line at certain spots. Mamma Mia is not something
I'm watching. Well, at least you're not a misogynist at all.
No, but I can't go there. Pride and Prejudice, Mamma Mia.
ABBA is great. Are you talking about the song or the movie?
I've seen both. The Mamma Mia musical. Like, I just can't do it.
There's no problem with it. You're all right. You can live.
I can not like it and be okay.
I draw the line at Letters to Juliet.
That's where I would say, yeah. You have a line.
Yeah.
All right, I'm just saying I have a line.
Which I've also seen, so I've been over it.
Okay, well, I haven't crossed my line.
I'm not a man of principle.
No? Flip-flopper. Anyway, Meryl Streep, back to her, the important stuff here. She has been nominated for 20 Oscars, winning three.
God.
And
treasure.
She's been nominated for 31 Golden Globes, winning eight. Plus, she won the Cecil B. DeMille Award. She's also won a bajillion other awards.
It's getting comical at this point. Like, stop. You know, either stop being awesome or stop throwing her in these nominations. She doesn't need more nominations. Let's put her in with the wins.
She needs wins.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tom Hanks, another schmo in this movie, journeyman actor with a paltry resume.
Never heard of him.
Hanks plays Ben Bradley, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Post during this time period. Hanks' last 10 years as an actor include Charlie Wilson's War.
Good movie.
Toy Story 3.
Great movie.
Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Exploitative movie.
Cloud Atlas. Ugh.
I think that was a movie.
Captain Phillips.
Look at me now.
Saving Mr. Banks.
I didn't see that movie.
Bridge of Spies.
You didn't like that movie.
I didn't like that movie. Yeah. Sully, which I like, Clint Eastwood.
Yes.
And he's set to star in good books coming up here. Greyhound Bios. I don't know if that's a book, but A Man Called Uwe. And Toy Story 4 over the next few years.
You keep sitting on that Toy Story property, and every 10 years, they could just print those out. And Disney needs a quick $1 billion. They'll just bring Tim Allen and Tom Hanks back in the theater, or the studio. Oh, Tim Allen's going to see. He's gotten a lot of backlash lately. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well,
he's another one on the list.
You can't do anything without politicizing the issues
Jesus
anymore.
Jesus H. Christ. Yeah. Bob Odenkirk plays renowned Washington Post writer Ben Bagdikian. Odenkirk's career highlights include Mr. Show, alongside fellow comedian David Cross. With Bob and David is another show recently
also
released.
In this movie.
Yes, David Cross. I'll mention him soon. Odenkirk has played Saul Goodman. It's All Good, Man. And Breaking Bad. And
oh my God, what have you just done?
And Better Call Saul. Anyway, Odenkirk has acted in Entourage, How I Met Your Mother, Nebraska, the Fargo TV series, The Disaster Artist with a cameo this year. Like I said, with Bob and David, he is set to voice a character in the upcoming Incredibles 2, and he's going to continue his role as Saul Goodman in Better Call Saul.
Yeah, he's phenomenal. I don't think we need to wax poetic much about him. He's just awesome.
High fives. Sarah Paulson plays Tony Bradley in The Post. Paulson is known for roles in Deadwood, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, Mud, 12 Years a Slave, Carol, and long stints on American Horror Story. She's like a new character on that
every
season.
She's the lead of that anthology, yeah.
And American Crime, where she played Marcia Clark to an Emmy and a Golden Globe win.
Oh, God, she was so good in that.
In the O.J. Simpson story there, Paulson has been nominated for 3 Golden Globes with a win, 6 Emmys with that one win.
And she, you're right, take notes. This is how you have a strong female character that doesn't do much in the movie but still can dominate a scene.
Dominates that one scene, great scene. Mm-hmm. Tracy Letts plays Fritz Beebe.
Looks nothing like his Lady Bird character.
Yeah, I don't like the wig here. It's just so obvious.
You are the most critical person of any wig.
There are
in
hair plugs.
You just
in this movie.
Like do you?
There are Hank's hair plugs.
Why
there
are you
Let's
so?
Hang
why
hair
do
plugs.
You zone in on that? Like,
I can't help it. I noticed these little dotty dots on the top of their forehead, and it's just it's hair right. plugs.
A Streep's wig, I will give you, was a little bizarre looking at times, but
I obsess over my own hairline. No, I mean it's just weird. It just all sticks right, out to me. Right. I don't look people in the eye, Mike. I look people in the hairline. No. Listen, Tracy Letts is a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright. As we've mentioned, he's written Bug, August, Osage County, Killer Joe, and Superior Donuts. Those are only the ones that have been adapted recently. He's also having a monster year as an actor, starring in The Lovers and Lady Bird.
Mm-hmm.
He's also been in Divorce, the HBO show, Elvis and Nixon, Indignation.
He was a lover and then he was divorced.
Yeah. Indignation, Christine, Wiener Dog, and he was kind of a regular for a season or two on Homeland. Carrie Coon, new favorite, Carrie Coon, plays Meg Greenfield in the newsroom of the Post. She burst onto the scene a few years ago with her roles in The Leftovers and Gone Girl.
She was very, very good in this movie.
She's also been in Strange Weather, The Keeping Hours, and the Fargo TV series. She's been nominated for one Emmy, and I don't have much of a problem with her like beehive hairdo here. I liked it. I like Meryl Streep's hairdo a little bit, too, but her beehive hairdo was perfect. That was awesome.
All right, very good.
Listen, the Post also stars Bradley Whitford from The West Wing.
Man that wears a hat half his life is casting dispersions on people's hairstyles. That's fine.
The Bradley Whitford in The West Wing, Billy Madison, Cabin in the Woods, and he is the father of Allison Williams in this year's Get Out. We've talked a lot about him. He's the man, or my man, as he might say.
He is. He's another guy. He's got to give props to his agent for getting him in all these big projects.
Alison Brie plays Lally Graham.
Didn't even know she was in this. That was a pleasant surprise.
Meryl Streep's daughter, Kay Graham's daughter in this movie. Brie has been in The Disaster Artist, Netflix's Glow, Netflix's BoJack Horseman, and The Little Hours just this year alone.
And also Someday I Hope to Marry Her.
She's married to Dave Franco, dude.
I'll marry him, too. They're both beautiful.
He's a fake brother. Yeah, that's true. He's a fake brother of James Franco. Oh, my God. I'm quoting the roast again. Here we go. Alison Brie is best known from her TV roles in Community and Mad Men before this breakout year for her in the movies. Jesse Plemons, who my brothers and I refer to as Fat Damon, we all just...
That's okay.
Okay. You liked it? There's a reaction?
All right.
Well, listen, we all just saw him in the first episode of the newest season of Black Mirror, USS McAllister, or USS Callister, excuse me.
Yes, the USS McAllister is the story of when Kevin from Home Alone goes into space.
Correct. Black Mirror, they're weird. They're cool and weird. Anyway, Fat Damon was also recently known for his role in the Fargo TV series, Hostiles, American Made, Other People.
This is not Fat Damon. He's Landry from Friday Night Lights. Everybody knows that.
Oh, I didn't even have Friday Nights.
Oh, what? That's like his coming out show. Yeah. Season 2 was awful. He accidentally killed someone.
I'm just tired of, you know, my brothers and I say, is that Matt Damon? He put on a little
weight. They don't look that much alike. I mean,
from afar, he looks a little alike.
But, all right.
He was in Other People, very good in Other People, one of my favorite movies of the last couple of years. Bridge of Spies, Olive Kitteridge. He was Todd in Breaking Bad.
Yes.
He was in Friday Night Lights. And he was Philip Seymour Hoffman's son in The Master. His weight fluctuates like a bouse. He's also been in Good Will Hunting and The Martian. Wait, nope. That's Matt Damon. He is Fat Damon. Did I get enough play on that little pun of a joke?
You've beaten that horse. That thing died back in the 70s when this movie took place.
It's funny to me. I'm also fat.
I was going to say, that's the joke
fat,
is said
I'm also Mike.
By two men that wish their weight would fluctuate.
All right, finally, to get the final rundown on the cast and crew here, The Post also stars Mr. Show's David Cross, The Americans' Matthew Rhys as Daniel Ellsberg,
another guy I love,
Zach Woods, Pat Healy, John Rue, Michael Cyril Creighton, Coral Pena, and oh yeah, Michael effing Stuhlbarg, who we've profiled in our Call Me By Your Name episode, and he's acted in every good movie of the last 15 years, most of the good TV shows. This year alone, he's had Call Me By Your Name, The Post, Shape of Water, and the Fargo TV series.
Once we're done with these Oscar sprint profiles, I'm not going to be able to go back to watching movies without either Chalamet or Stuhlbarg in them, so that's going to be a problem for me.
I don't think it'll be a problem for you because they're going to be in every movie.
I have to just tape them on my television or on the movie screen I'm watching.
They've been in the last 15 years. Well, no, the kid hasn't been in much, but Stolberg's been in the last 15 movies. So you said Or?
Yeah, either okay. one. Either
as long, one. As, long yeah. as it's Or.
So take note, Hollywood. If you
Some story inception.
Fix that, please, for me.
Bruce Greenwood, I forgot to talk about him. He's Robert McNamara in the movies. He played JFK in 13 Days, which was a big movie for me growing up. He was also in this year's Gerald's Game, which we reviewed in our Netflix movie originals pod.
Episode 9, got a lot of hits.
He's also been in Bruce Greenwood. He's been in American Crime Story, Star Trek, Capote, Rules of Engagement, and Double Jeopardy, to mention some of my and my grandfather's favorites.
Double Jeopardy,
it's my grandfather's favorite movie
of all
time.
Is that Ashley Judd and Tommy Lee Jones?
That's Ashley Judd and Tommy Lee Jones. Can't be tried for this.
I love that movie.
A lot of people do. I liked it back in the day. I haven't seen it in 15 years.
Oh, yeah, it's been a while.
I saw it with my grandpa, God rest his soul, years ago, and we loved it. And then I would always catch him watching it at the weirdest times. That was kind of funny. The family liked that movie. Some story inception. Former Sony chair and longtime producer Amy Pascal, who kind of lost her chairmanship when the leaks
the
happened.
Email
at Sony.
Crisis. Yeah, that was a big deal.
James Franco 3 years ago? Fault again,
as he is for everything, rightfully so, apparently.
But listen, Amy Pascal won the rights to Liz Hanna's first screenplay that she was able to sell back in October of 2016.
Spielberg, good for her for taking this as her first major project, too.
Right. Spielberg was making Ready Player One when he gets a call from Casey Snyder and Amy Pascal, who tell him they found a script from a 31-year-old writer who's never sold a script before, who wrote a story about Liz Graham. And Spielberg was really reluctant on that terrible pitch to read it. And by page 30, he was changing his mind. He was saying, okay, Meryl has to play Graham. Tom has to play Bradley. It'll be my fifth film with Tom. I got to work with Meryl. That's going through Spielberg's head.
He gets to do in real life what we all do, like if we're sitting thinking about making a movie. You know, like, okay, I would have Tom Hanks do this. I would have Meryl Streep, and then your friends laugh at you. But no, Spielberg gets to actually do these things.
Yes, he does. Spielberg had an entire crew in Italy getting ready to film the kidnapping of Edoardo Mortara, where he was still trying to find a 6-year-old boy to carry this movie out there in Italy. Spielberg, the week before he said yes to the Post, had watched 3,000 audition tapes trying to cast this role for the little kid, and it didn't go well. He totally puts the project on the side and says, I am in for the Post.
At what point do you think he got sick of the audition tapes? Like, give me a number.
4. He started thinking about Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks and Ben Bradley and Kay Graham. So Spielberg knew the film, The Post, couldn't wait 2 or 3 years, and he makes a push to get it all the way on top of his production list. Again, his production company's a well-oiled machine.
Yeah, the surprising story of this is how quickly he got and turned it into an actual movie. I think most people, if they were to learn when this started, would be shocked to see this be up for a nomination in 2017.
Right. It was a harrowing journey just to see if they can get it in before the awards were done being voted on and whatnot, and obviously getting released before the end of the year. Amy Pascal had already passed the script to Meryl Streep, and she was just waiting for it to happen. She was in. She was attached, one of the first people to be attached, which is why Spielberg loved it so much.
Gotta be exciting for
Hanks, as he puts it. Yeah, Hanks, as he puts it, was just sitting around. And
as Tom Hanks does.
So that drew a laugh from the Washington Post press conference crowd there that I'm drawing a lot of this information from. So if you want to watch that hour-long video press conference, it was a pretty good one. Funnier than I am.
Let's shout out here. The reason Mike is so prepared, I got to see a little behind the scenes of his prep work today, and he goes ham on researching these things, and all the credit in the world to him for digging up all these little nuggets from various info sites.
I try to plagiarize from the best and take from, you know.
If you're going to copy.
We're not making anybody. We try to cite everything. We're not making any money yet, but yeah, I mean, seriously, we're having.
Emphasis on yet. We're available for ads.
Maybe we'd have to change our tact.
We'll change nothing.
Anyway, Hanks says he was just sitting around, but he heard Steven and Meryl were attached, and he was playing Ben Bradley, so he was in.
Yeah, why not?
Joss Singer, the writer of Spotlight, came on and helped reshape the script into something that was Spielbergian. Liz Hanna did a nice job with the core role of Meryl Streep's character, and they wanted to make it more of a political and, you know, journalistic thriller, I guess.
I'm trying to remember the last Spielberg movie that lacked any semblance of an action scene whatsoever.
I'm going to have to read this Liz Hanna script because, the opening Vietnam shot maybe, but you're right. There's not a lot of action here. I think they dramatized the pace a bit.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But, you're right. It's not as Spielbergian as we'd think. Yeah. I want to compare and contrast the original Liz Hanna script, what drew the attention of Steven Spielberg and Amy Pascal.
That would be very
for a first-time screenwriter.
Like
that
would turn to page 22 and there's just $8,000 in cash in there for them.
And
I suddenly have interest in this
pictures
script.
From their cell phones, blackmailing them. No, I mean, Liz
a
Hanna.
A video of them in real time looking at the script.
Liz Hanna nailed the central arc of this, and I don't want to say.
It's unreal.
Yeah, I don't want to say Josh Singer fucked it up, but I don't know. Somebody fucked up some of it. Anyway.
Mike has his issue. We're going to obviously talk about it as we always do, but unlike The Darkest Hour, the roles were kind of reversed for this one. I seem to enjoy it more than Mike did.
It's still an amazing accomplishment for a first-time screenwriter to get it in the hands.
How about the first-timers doing everything? Liz Hanna writing this, Jordan Peele directing the horror, Greta Gerwig directing her first movie solo. Big props to everyone involved. Big year for Hollywood for diversity, minorities. And
you start employing the other half of the population.
Yeah, right. When you open your doors a little bit and open your eyes.
Exactly.
Look what happens.
The anecdote about how Matthew Reese / Daniel Ellsberg had the meeting with McNamara and then how he watched the Secretary of Defense be interviewed by the press and lie. That was one of the first scenes of the movie. To research this movie, Spielberg and Hanks had watched The Fog of War, the excellent documentary about Robert McNamara. They were both friends with Ken Burns and obtained over 10 hours of documentary research
because
from him.
Because, of course, Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks are friends with Ken Burns.
And, oh, yeah, they interviewed Daniel Ellsberg and Kay Graham before filming and reshaping their story.
They have
some ins.
But is there joy in their lives? when you can do
success.
Anything you want and you're successful at everything you've ever done, do you have joy?
It might just be like a Foo Fighters song, man. Everlong?
Yeah. They're going to break out into Best of You or something.
You're
right there.
Better at musical references than me. Production notes. Principal photography began on May 2017 in New York City, so that's a quick turnaround.
May 2017, and this thing was available at the end of the year.
Most of the movies we've done so far have been like 2016 shoots, right?
Yeah.
After production began in New York, many of the biggest personalities at the New York Times objected to the fact that the Post didn't put more of an emphasis on how the New York Times had broke the story, calling it at one point a good movie.
Oh, I totally disagree with that.
They called it a good movie, but bad history.
Times were all over this movie. I think there was a ton of deference given to the Times.
They had a problem with it. Artistic license was taken on the Washington Post. They may have been chasing the New York Times, but so was everyone at that age. And Tom Hanks mentioned that, in fact, the competition was mostly between Ben Bradley and the Post with the Washington Star at the time. So they weren't really in the national spotlight at all. During the promotion of the film, which is a great interview and video on
Pornhub.
The Washington Post film critic asked Steven Spielberg if he was worried about making such a political film, would it alienate people? And Spielberg and the whole cast kind of jumped in and said, this is not a partisan film. It's a patriotic film. Odenkirk jumped in and said, it's only a partisan film if you really like Nixon.
Yeah, or government secrets.
Right.
So, if you hate the First Amendment.
Spielberg said something particularly great that goes back to a conversation we've had a couple times about movies versus TV movies. And he says that, listen, a movie should be a movie when it's released in theaters. And a TV movie, when it's released for small screen TVs, should be considered a TV movie.
Go figure.
The Oscars should deal primarily with movies. The Emmys should deal primarily in TV movies.
It's an argument that we've had on this very show talking about that.
Meryl followed up and said, I'm sorry, but I think size matters. And Tom Hanks made a quip from there that I didn't write down, which was funny and self-deprecating. I like them both. I really do. Yeah. So, that's my production profile of The Post.
All right, let's do some specs for the Post now. Written by Liz Hannon and Josh Singer and directed by Spielberg, as Mike told you. The runtime of 116 minutes and distributed by 20th Century Fox for the U.S. rights. Universal Studios has the international distribution rights. Hmm. Came out on December 14th, 2017. Debuted at the Newseum in Washington, D.C.
That can't be a real place.
Which is, it's like a museum, but with an N.
They have our sense of humor. I actually like them now.
It's like a living monument to the First Amendment, freedom of press. Went limited run December 22nd and went wide just a couple days ago, January 12th, because everybody wanted to celebrate my birthday.
Big audiences.
$50 million budget for this movie. It has thus far grossed $30.1 million, with all but $2.5 million of that coming domestically.
Solid.
Probably on its way to getting at least its money back.
Yeah,
I
would solid.
Be surprised if a Meryl Streep, Steven Spielberg, Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks movie didn't do well
right.
in the box office.
Right.
As far as critical reception and how it did out of the gates, a 7.5 IMDb rating thus far on 7,300 plus reviews, 88% certified fresh Rotten Tomato rating with the average critic score of an 8 out of 10 on 238 critical reviews, with all but 10 of which have been positive. Only a 74% audience score, though, with an average rating of 3.7 out of 5 on 6,000 plus reviews. Also got an 83 Metascore from Metacritic, which, as we said in our last pod, is quite a bit higher than The Darkest Hour. It's 5 points below Three Billboards, 3 points below Shape of Water, and even a full 9 points behind The Florida Project.
Interesting.
Middle of the road. Critics seem to love it. Audiences are a little more tepid. Kind of an interesting breakdown there. It's getting a reputation, like I said at the top of the episode, for being the movie that has all the filler nominations. If a certain category can't land on a fifth entrant, someone from the Post usually gets thrown in just to round out the category. It's probably going to be one of those, like I said, I wouldn't be surprised to see it with 7 or 8 decent number of Oscar nominations, not many wins.
Fillers, that's an interesting way to put it.
I don't like putting it that way, but I don't can't not
I think you're
savvy
right.
enough
yeah,
to think of another way to put
right.
it. Its success has been limited thus far as taking home actual award wins. Like, you can imagine, it's gotten heavily nominated. 6 Golden Globe nominations, original score, best screenplay, best director for Spielberg, lead actress Meryl Streep, lead actor Tom Hanks, best picture drama, 0 wins. 8 Critics' Choice nominations, best score, best acting ensemble, best director Spielberg, best original screenplay, actor Hanks, lead actress Streep, best editing, best picture, 0 wins.
Wow.
0 SAG nominations to its name, but it did find itself in the AFI's top 10 list for top 10 films of 2017. Even the various Critics Circles Awards haven't found much luck for this film in terms of it landing awards throughout the awards season. According to IMDb, thus far, it only has 8 total Critics Circle wins for anything from Best Picture to Best Ensemble related to its win. 2 of those wins actually come in the form of Best Body of Work Awards for Michael Stuhlbarg, where his work in this movie isn't even mentioned. He's more mentioned for his work in Call Me By Your Name
right.
and
The Shape of Water.
The Shape of Water,
everything.
Yes, sorry. Those were the
and the worst ones. Wig of the movie, by the way.
Those awards coming from the Oklahoma Film Critics Circle and the San Diego Film Critics Society. Its biggest win thus far, though, has been from the National Board of Review, as one might imagine, which has been responsible for giving Hanks and Streep their lone lead actor, lead actress award wins of the season, as well as giving The Post its lone best picture win of the year. So this is what we're dealing with. I mean, it's a Steven Spielberg. It definitely has an Oscar feel. But for me, going into it, before we talk about expectations, it kind of felt the same problem as The Darkest Hour, where that it's just the wrong year for something like this that could come out any year to come out.
Yeah, it's possible. I think the awards projections are going down a little bit. Feinberg still has it up there. Best Picture, Actor, Actress, Cinematography, Costume Design, Film Editing, and Original Score. It's a front runner for. Major threat for director, screenplay, and production design. That was original screenplay. Gold Derby calls BS on a lot of that, Mike. Yeah, they say Best Picture 30 for 30. I mean, with 2 first places. So they think it's going to get a Best Picture.
There it
nod.
Is again. The nomination, but only 2 wins on 30.
Director, 30. They say 12 out of 30. And thank the gods. But no offense to Steven Spielberg.
Of course.
We've canceled them already several meetings and interviews thus far.
Cancel Steven Spielberg.
Best Actress, Meryl Streep, is 28 out of 30 in the top 5.
Another token nomination.
Actor is only 13 out of 30, Tom Hanks. So that's dipping.
It's interesting.
And I'm going to have something to say about that. Cinematography, which Feinberg said was a front runner. 0 out of 28 experts on Gold Derby seemed to agree with him.
Wow.
14 out of 29 have it up for original screenplay, and that should be lower. Costume design, 1 out of 26, and thank the gods. Makeup and hairstyling, 0 out of 25. Again, thank the gods. I'm right. Film editing, 6 out of 26.
Not so much there either.
Original score, 14 out of 26. It's got a shot. And production design, no, 3 out of 26.
Yeah,
so.
You wonder, again, does Feinberg know something that the Gold Derby experts don't?
He has in the past.
Shout out to Feinberg, by the way, for putting us in our place and showing us that picture of him interviewing Willem Dafoe for his Florida project.
Making a joke about the same thing we made a joke about a few days earlier, Willem and William.
We appreciate that shout out if he happens to listen to this. But nonetheless, it seems that we're dealing again with a property that is getting recognized maybe more for the cachet of the people involved more so than the story it tells.
Yeah.
I think that's an argument that could be made. I don't know that I necessarily agree with it.
I'm going to have words on
that. Yeah. So let's get into expectations. What were you expecting going in, Mike?
The cast and the subject matter could not have been more enticing to me.
It's like a steak, right? It's like a big, juicy steak sitting there waiting for you.
You're going to hear some noises come out of my mouth.
Per usual.
He was just during the break, he was just talking about milkshakes, getting me all hot and bothered over here. Now he's talking about steaks. But you're right. Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks, the supporting cast is extraordinary.
Yep.
But listen, I was a little worried by the reviews. I was a little worried about the bad buzz that preceded its release. I was very worried after Bridge of Spies and the BFG, two movies I did not like by Steven Spielberg before this one. So I wonder if lofty expectations hurt my first viewing experiences and I had to chill out and see it a few more times. I still don't love it, though. I'll have a mixed review in a certain way, and I'll poke Mike in the eye.
I'm in the same ballpark as you, though. I mean, you hear it's a political thriller done by Spielberg, starring Streep and Hanks and all these great undercard actors that are going to do the supporting roles.
We're friends because we have things in common.
I don't know if my expectations could have. I wonder, though, if people are starting to suffer from real life, quote unquote, fatigue. You know, these movies that are taking these still shots in time about either these historical events that happen or these type of people that live these hardship lives, such as the Florida Project.
When reality sucks, I think you're supposed to do something. I don't know.
It doesn't ring a bell. But yeah, I wonder if that's playing into it at all. The movies, as a means of escapism, haven't really had that this year so much. I don't know that that's a bad thing either, though. I mean, we're getting the Lady Birds and the Get Outs because of it. So who knows? I mean, I just wonder if that's kind of has to do with the poor reception that it feels.
I mean, as an issue movie, I think it's certainly well-intentioned. It's another one of those movies that I agree with a lot of the, you know, soapboxing. I love what they're saying. In many cases, I love how they're saying it. It's just, there's going to be a few things that Radio Raheem, love, hate. It feels like one of those tips, you know, it's back to our retrospectives. We have a lot of that, you know, reviewing those old movies, and we got a lot of love, hate. And this movie, for me, is just typical Oscar nom, that savory food, that almost like a fast food, not a fast food chain, but like I won't say the name of the restaurant chain, but it rhymes with Schmoutback and EGI Fridays.
No. EGI.
Schmapplebees.
Good luck, detectives. You're like, this is the killer in the snowman.
I actually really want to go to...
Leaving terrible clues behind.
I shouldn't have come here so hungry. I mean, Schmapplebees sounds wonderful right now. Anyway, I'd go to any one of them, actually. Sponsor us? No. Anyway, it's like one of those kind of meals where it's just, it's really good. It's dependable. It's something, you know, going to a regular diner or something, but it's nothing super special. And I guess I'll talk about that. But want to head into production value?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do some sight to sound stuff.
So I was actually going to go sound to sight, if
of course
that's cool
you,
with
son of a
you,
bitch.
You highness, your highness.
Go ahead.
Soundtrack, listen, enough with the CCR,
another
playing
Vietnam
over.
Movie, another opening shot of chopper sounds with that John Fogerty lyrics in the background, yeah.
Dude, I wondered if I was overreacting. The first time I saw this, I just got angry when I sat down in a movie. So
here's an interesting question. Are we sure other bands existed during Vietnam? Because all you hear CCR and John Fogerty.
I went on, HowardStern.com had a little analysis on Fortunate Son and said 19 movies, and yes, it was the song of the Vietnam era.
Also,
Vietnam movies.
He never says Fortunate Son during those lyrics.
No, it's Green River. It's the song in this this movie is Green River, you jerk. But listen, Forrest Gump, Tropic Thunder, To Heal a Nation, Dear America, those are Vietnam movies where CCR is playing. And now, Tropic Thunder and Forrest Gump are movies we both watched a lot for the pod, not for the pod.
Yeah.
That's not enough for me, though. Like, where else have I heard CCR in conjunction with Vietnam? Well, Battlefield Vietnam, the video game, Call of Duty Black Ops, friends, family, playing video games to that music. But here's another thing, and this is probably where it really drives home and gets super duper ridiculously repetitive. When soldiers going into a jungle, going into an area, that when they're locking and loading in the movies, War Dogs, The Expendables, Red Dawn, Kong Skull Island, and Suicide Squad, in those five recent movies, you're hearing CCR playing over it. The locking and loading.
It's interesting,
scenes.
Too. I mean, this has nothing to do with the movie, so now we'll get it way off base. But I know Fogerty had a big falling out with his studio over who owns the rights to the CCR material. And I'm almost positive he's not seeing a dime from any of it. It's just the studio licensing the CCR music out. So don't blame John Fogerty.
I love CCR, man. I hate the Eagles, man. I like CCR. I loved it in The Big Lebowski. It's like my favorite use of a song in any movie. So I love their music going way back. However, I'm done with the Vietnam cliched
and
opening.
The chopper sounds, too.
The chopper sounds, the locking and loading. And this is why those movies I just listed, when Matthew Reese is doing it in the very first shots of this movie.
Literally the opening shot of the movie.
I'm starting off on the wrong foot. So that was the soundtrack for me. And really, the score is something I don't remember. What did you think of the score? Do you remember it?
I can't remember a John Williams score being so unmemorable.
Silvestri took over for him. John Williams didn't stay on the whole production. Again, they're fast-tracking this so much that maybe that's why. I remember reading that somewhere. Might be wrong.
Let this be on record that Mike is calling Silvestri a piece of human garbage.
I don't know the motif of that.
No,
I like his name, he ends in a vowel.
I just can't, it didn't do much for me. Again, score is a very jaded section of my life right now in dealing with any film score after what happened with the Golden Globes and Critics' Choice. But if I was in front of me again, I don't think I'd recognize it.
We're Zimmer guys. Let's just say.
Yeah.
We're Zimmer
guys. We're big suck-ups for Hans Zimmer there.
Listen, the editing was
I love Williams' work. I mean, his Star Wars stuff is classic. It didn't connect for me here.
Oh, I mean, Indiana Jones.
Yeah, everything he's been attached with. Spielberg's back.
Classic, no question. The editing is fast-paced when it needs to be. Let's face it, there's a lot of Spielbergian production values that definitely have a super high level of quality that are just, you know, when you go into a Spielberg movie, you're going to get that level of production value.
Yeah, the drama he's able to elicit just through dialogue alone is something that I feel like was sorely lacking in Darkest Hour. I know you feel the opposite, but...
I feel the opposite with this one, but that's just me. Listen, costume design.
Wrong!
I hated the costume design in this one, dude. You have all these recognizable
actors.
You
have a big chip about this, and after watching, I don't understand why.
Because I want to believe what I'm watching on screen, because I want to escape into a La La Land reality that's not my own, and I'm looking at Michael Stuhlbarg in a wig. I'm looking at Tracy Letts in a wig. I'm looking at actors that I've seen 75 times at all of my rewatches in movies this year.
Weird fetish about hairlines.
It might be a fetish. That's a problem. That's a me problem. Anyway, listen, this is not Tom Hanks and Da Vinci Code bad, but it's close with Tom Hanks.
No, it's not Tom Hanks and Da Vinci Code bad.
It's close. I mean, that little doo-wop, little swoosh on his hair with him and Stuhlbarg.
Look, maybe it's me.
Is that like the editor-in-chief swoosh that they all have to have?
There's some parts, like I said, there's especially a scene towards the end with Meryl Streep. It looks pretty bad, the wig that she's sporting there. But look, all the outfits in the newsroom and most of the hairstyles, for as ridiculous as they are objectively, I mean, they all were pretty uniform too. So you believe these people all could have existed in the same
time.
None
of them had hair loss back in the 1970s if they were drinking.
I'm also sure black people existed, right? And there's none to be found in this movie.
None.
No minorities whatsoever.
Zero. Over under one? Nope.
Yeah, no. So
listen, Tracy Letts, that wig was particularly gruesome. And the David Cross, especially after seeing
David Cross, I could see having a problem with his hairpiece
because he's so renowned as a bald guy, right?
But that's what it takes for me to have as much of an issue with it.
So I think, you know, the casual moviegoer, you commoners. No, the casual moviegoer.
You scum.
The casual moviegoer who doesn't have to rewatch these movies 100,000 times and see them again and again, and every day you're spent is in a fancy
Your eye for the makeup and the costume design is much more critical, I think, than mine.
It
so
has
that's
to
fair.
Be. Well, it just is. I can't help it.
No, that's fair. That's fair. I mean, I'm sure you're not the only one that feels that these were ridiculous.
Anything else on production values or
some of the shots I wanted to bring up? I thought, I mean, it's Spielberg, so how much can you say? Oh, this was a great job by this director shooting it this way.
I can't believe he was able to accomplish something.
I thought it was a lot of the camera up high, shooting down and making people look small during the big moments. He does it when Kay is on the phone at the end, getting everyone's opinion as to whether she should. And he does it to Odenkirk when he's meeting with the Matthew Rhys character, and Matthew Rhys is you're going to publish this, right? And it makes Odenkirk look so small in perspective of the scene.
Right.
A lot of he did a good job of making the characters seem less important than the moments, which I think was the point. Because, you know, it was the First Amendment at stake, and I think that's what you're supposed to take away from this movie.
He moved the camera quite a bit in this one,
too. He did.
That was cool to see. And it, you know, it's not something you notice in the first watch, but after a couple times where you kind of dug in, it's something you feel, and then you're seeing it, and you're like, oh, wow, that's why I felt this way.
He shot Mayhem pretty well, too. When they're going through the papers in Tom Hanks' living room, they're all sprawled out.
Oh, yeah, that was fun.
The tracking shot where he's following the guy who has the paper in the newsroom, walking down the corridor of the newsroom, and you see all that. It was a lot. I mean, again, yes, I'm blowing Steven Spielberg for being a good director, but these were a lot of great shots.
He knows how to get those movie magic working a little bit, and you get that in this movie. There's no question.
This feels like a Spielberg movie.
Yes, and it's a good movie. There's no question it's a good movie. My problems are just going to come, like, is it an elite top 10, top 7 Academy Award movie of the year? And that's where I'm at.
What about on sound? You got anything on sound?
Nothing major. How about you?
If we're doing dialogue as sound, we did just talk about this, but I have a problem with the, and I know you mentioned in Darkest Hour, the expositional dialogue you had an issue with, and I could see it in this movie without question. One of the first, when Matthew Rhys takes the Pentagon Papers out, we see him walk them out of the CIA building. When he's making copies of them, he's reading the headlines that are flashing across the screen.
And we find out later in the movie that it took him like a month to get the whole study.
Yes, whereas the movie presented
so he's
going to
get
one,
all
yeah.
those headlines in one night of the copier within a 10-minute montage. It's total BS. No, and it's just so obvious. Like it's a little bit lazy.
Which was the problem I had in Darkest. I mean, you rationalized it. You made points where it seemed like it fit. I don't know that I can make points that seem like this fit. I didn't mind the hand holding because I personally didn't know much about the Pentagon Papers.
Yep.
The whole excursion, but hand-holding to that extent, I think, is a little much.
It's a necessary evil. I just wish they made it more cinematic. It didn't make sense in the scene that he was talking out loud to himself in the room.
Exactly.
Before the newsreel footage of the president's speeches actually played to us.
Yes.
And it just didn't make sense. Like, you have it, it's like ham-handed and lazy. And if they had another month to write the screenplay, another 2 months.
That's true, too. They were up against it trying to get this in for award season, obviously. Who knows what would have happened if they sat on another 2 months and waited for 2018.
I have a problem with the dialogue in this movie at times. I think when they have to do the expositional dialogue, sometimes it works. Some of the construction of the scenes is very well done. And I think a lot of the stuff surrounding Meryl Streep is extremely well done.
Her whole story is
I loved her arc. And I think that's, you know, Liz Hannah has to be what sold Steven Spielberg about this first-time screenwriter Liz Hannah's script here. So it has to be what they took from it. And I think they brought Joss Singer in to do more of the procedural stuff, and he's probably up against it. And you know, Spotlight is one of those movies that'll kind of immerse you years later. I like it more every time I watch it, but it does kind of just tell you what's going on instead of being overly cinematic at times, or at least there's an element of tell, not show. Now,
that's fair.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing, like when we talked about expositional dialogue, either being a necessary evil, either being just necessary, flat out necessary, or when there's so much other subtext going on and so many great performances going on around it that you tolerate it, right? And that happens a lot in this film. Like, I will tolerate Meryl Streep reading anything. She can read the back of a shampoo bottle.
Sure, right, right.
And make it dramatic. And she does that, and I'm
which is what she's doing in the Mamma Mia sequel, I think.
Yeah, I'm watching this movie a second time.
Head and Shoulders.
Right, I'm watching
Here
this
I go. No, never mind.
That's terrible. That's so bad. You're great. I like you a lot. Listen, Meryl Streep is, you know, reading these lines, and she's just going off in this movie, whether she's talking to her daughter, whether she's talking to Hanks, and there's so much on her face, and there's so much going on, and you know she's pulling off the subtext while reading these kind of, you know, on-the-nose lines, unfortunately. But
did you feel like anyone was overmatched in a scene with her?
No, because she's such a great actress that she
that
lets
Allison
them
Brie scene didn't,
work with
didn't,
her.
Didn't bug you?
I liked Allison Brie in this movie, but it bugged me a little bit in the first time because she's almost, and upon rewatch, she's not doing it as much, but it's almost a little in bad taste because she's like, oh, I remember when my husband and your father did this and blah, 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 blah. It's not to that extent, but there's a tone that where it's happening like that that I didn't like.
It almost seemed to me like Allison, and good Lord, if I was ever near Meryl Streep, never mind on set supposed to be acting against her, yeah. But like I felt as if she was almost watching her perform. Because Meryl Streep is doing so above and beyond with a myriad of emotions in that scene.
And then Meryl Streep's like, oh, do you remember when this humongous event in our past happened and this is what we said to each other?
Yeah.
You know, like one of those scenes. It's like that's not ever going to happen.
But as far as the hand-holding goes, I felt it's really interesting because there's a juxtaposition that where The Darkest Hour didn't do basically any and they relied on the audience to bring in their own opinions and form their own conclusions about certain things that happened. And The Post may have done too much and it gave me a chance to digest, well, which would I prefer? I think I almost prefer too much as long as it can be done in a way, like you were just saying, where you have an actress the caliber of Streep doing it.
Right.
I almost prefer that being done to make sure that the audience sees and is able to completely grasp the seriousness and the I'm going to say it again, it was the word of The Darkest Hour for me, but the stakes of the situation, the gravity of the situation.
And it's clear. There's no question.
Right.
It's and economical and it's the clarity is
to
there.
To me, at least, it's able to, it brings the audience in more of an envelope to let you know how serious the circumstances are, as opposed to The Darkest Hour, we had a whole, you know, 20 half hour minute argument about I felt there were no stakes or nobody acted like the stakes were that great.
The thing,
and they were obviously more greater there.
The thing is for me, like I got a list of like 75 movies that are 86 or better on the year. And they've all done that like very well. So it's like,
it's not to say that I think this is the best picture winner.
Right.
Right. In terms of what I'd rather have done too much or not enough.
You're totally
right. I lean too much.
This movie's totally watchable. It's super important subject matter. I like Battle of the Sexes and Marshall. There's a ton that I agree with that's being said. There's a ton that I applaud for being said in a movie, but expositional dialogue is annoying, and the lack of dramatization by a lot of the scene construction, especially when you don't get as much procedural stuff as you want. I loved when this movie got procedural, and I think that's, you know, his bag. You know, Steven Spielberg, when he does one of these movies, I love the Bob Odenkirk stuff when he was actually, you know, you get a little journalist side plot, because this is not a movie about journalism. It's a movie about publishing. And which is fine.
It's just the story of Kay, yeah.
Right, but you know, it's misled slightly, and I think first watch on this, I thought it was going to be more of an All the President's Men, more of a spotlight, which are movies about.
And I don't think you're alone in that, because I think if you get present the IMDb, you know, what this movie is about, the two sentence plot synopsis to someone, they're going to think, okay, so this is basically a decade later on, or 5 years before All the President's Men. This is the pre-Watergate All the President's Men. And that's not what this movie is.
No, and it's a movie about the publisher, Meryl Streep. It's a movie about feminism. It's a movie about her character that takes some sidetracks and side trails into the journalism world. But, you know, the New York Times would have been the story of how this came to be and the leak and the journalism and you know, over the month of time or the couple months of time where Neil Sheehan and company had weighed the options of whether or not to publish and done all the due diligence, et cetera, et cetera. That's the journalism story behind this. You know, they followed a few breadcrumbs of Bob Odenkirk character. Those scenes are fun as shit. I love them.
He played a very interesting character in this movie, which is a weak way of saying it, but he was not only the comedic relief, but he was also, like you said, he was doing the investigating that you see, the POV of the investigating, the reporting done,
yes,
is done through his character.
Yes.
So he's not only providing the one-liners that make you at ease comedically, but he's also a pretty important character in terms of they don't get the papers at the Post if it's not for him.
Right. He's a legendary reporter at the Washington Post.
Bagdikian, yeah.
Bagdikian, Ben Bagdikian. A ton of journalism majors have just put him up on their dorm room walls for many years.
I had a poster of ABBA.
He did a nice job. Yes, I loved Odenkirk in this movie. He had some of the best scenes. But the movie doesn't get procedural enough for my liking.
That's also a fair criticism.
I like that stuff. I love the Zodiac, you know, movie, all that behind the scenes stuff with Gyllenhaal tracking it down. I love a great, you know,
why done it. Yeah. This movie, like you said, it's a good watch. It's fun. There's definitely enough to get invested into. I don't think it's the best picture. It should be nominated, I think, but I don't think it's going to win, or it should win. I do think that one of the stronger things it did was present a bunch of other movies that could be made about this time period.
Right.
I mean, you don't even think about, like, you know, first of all, who that girl was that dropped off the first papers at the Post, where she came from.
That's Steven Spielberg's daughter, by the way.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, that's a great story. You're right. That's not just a juicy story.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of other little subplots that can be turned into motion pictures of their own that went into getting to where this is for Kay to make her decisions.
Again, that's why this is a publishing movie more than it's
because
they're essentially gifted the Pentagon Papers, and I know, and that's not really a spoiler. It falls into their laps. It's not something that they have to really go out and find and dig up.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm with you there totally. The businessman, Bradley Whitford, might as well have had an eye patch and GERD just too thick. And here's the problem. Yes, he's an amalgam of business interests going against Meryl
But
Streep.
The bankers!
Yeah. Yes, he's representing chauvinism and underestimating the female boss, underestimating Kay Graham. And I don't
deny... Let's put a pin on that subject. Not the Bradley Whitford, but I want to talk more in spoilers about Kay Graham being underestimated throughout the movie.
Yes. So do I. I have a bunch of stuff on that. I don't deny that chauvinism like this existed, that it still exists, and in much worse forms, right?
Oh, yeah.
However, we've seen Bradley Whitford this year play sinister and play
a better baddie,
subtle, mm-hmm, and play a better villainous character.
Yes, totally agree.
With undertones, with
subtlety.
Subtlety,
with death.
He's a blustering buffoon this entire movie, and it's just a damn shame, a waste of his talent. And you know what? They're going to get accused. Here's the thing. Like, the blowback that Meryl Streep talks about, that she's afraid of coming against the Time's Up movement. Like, when you portray an irredeemable character like this, and he's so obviously one direction, it's just like you're calling...
Like Harry Styles?
Yeah, you're just calling somebody a villain.
Well, I wonder, too, because obviously Spielberg's no dummy, I wonder, too, if that was done intentionally, because... Everyone knows what Bradley Whitford's capable of, and like you said, we've seen it already this year. Is he making a statement against the banks, since Bradley Whitford was representing the bankers' interest to be the big blustery
white man?
You know, like, was he poking fun at them? Who knows?
Banker white man, evil,
right?
Telling the woman what not to do, and
it's a parody into of itself.
We see it like this parody of a performance. Is a great word for it, and it's just a shame because you could have done it more sinister, and in many ways, more chauvinistic, right? I mean, his character in other movies, I won't say which, you know, when he acts as a villain, like, you don't see him coming necessarily, and he just is so effective.
Yeah, I'm not arguing at all with
he's
that.
He's such
You're
a great actor,
right.
And I love The West Wing so damn much, and I hate to see him misused. So that was a major
problem. And he was great
in
Billy Madison.
Yes. Eric.
Eric!
Giving the company to Eric. But yeah, that's my final thoughts.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's jump in. We're getting a little long here. We've been going long lately on these, and our apologies, but hopefully we're giving you enough that you can sink your teeth into, because...
I give it a watch, though. Yeah.
I don't think there's any question. I mean, this is a good time killer, if nothing else. I mean, it's something you have to devote your attention to.
It's a meal at Schmapplebee's. You got to love it.
But you should devote your attention to something like this. The subject matter is very serious.
Riblets.
Yeah. And I think also, just a part on this note, he did a good enough job. I mean, if the First Amendment is if news organizations are dictated by the government, this all falls apart, man. All of this that we have, it could all go to hell.
Super important. It's just better done in All the President's Men, unfortunately.
Again, if you go in thinking this is All the President's Men, it's not All the President's Men.
It's not.
Let's hit the spoiler music. Spoilers ahead!
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, Mike, and Oscar! Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
All right, we're in the spoiler section. Hope you got your dance moves out. This is the spoiler section of Steven Spielberg's The Post, the loving combining of Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep and my heart. All in one movie.
The supporting cast of your dreams.
Yeah, it's loaded. Loaded cast all around. The budget for this movie, they're lying. It wasn't $30 million. It had to be at least seven times that for the talent that's at this movie.
Yeah, just to secure the talent.
But this is the spoiler section. We're going to talk about the ins and outs, all the storylines, and how they concluded. If you want to hear about box office specs, production values, performance reviews, all of that good stuff we have in the first 50 or so minutes, go ahead and head back there. You're not going to want to hear this part. But if you've seen the movie, or if you're just curious to see how it ended, hear about how it ended, you're in the right part. So let's start. Let's do some best and worst scenes.
Best sequence for me, I love the sequence with the actual decision that Kay Graham has to make. I thought that was great. They're going back and forth between Tom Hanks at Ben Bradley's house. I love that whole sequence too, with all the reporters on the floor and the daughter selling lemonade. But in the big dilemma sequence where they pull Kay Graham, Meryl Streep, out of the party.
Yes.
She comes into the room, surrounded by the guys. She finally stands up for herself. She finally tells Bradley Whitford with the devil horns on his head where to stick it. And she just does a remarkable job acting in that scene. She might win a nomination in that scene alone, even though she's great in others. I love the scene in the boardroom that set that one up. And I'm amazed by Tom Hanks, being a cheerleader in the big scene, and it's awesome to watch his reactions to what
Kay's
doing.
The smirk he has on his face, but right before Kay gives her final decision, when she's asking his opinion, while Bradley Whitford still is on his last leg, desperately pleading with her, and Tom Hanks is in the background, they're just smirking, knowing that it's going to go his way. I thought that was an unbelievable
touch. Terrific. It's great drama. It's a great dilemma.
And for sure.
There's no obvious answer.
Acted the shit out of it, as Streep always does with everything.
Love that stuff. So, yeah, what about you?
That goes more, the Streep stuff, I don't know if you want to touch on it now, if you want to kind of interweave this, but she was treated in a very misogynistic way, which I obviously wasn't around in the 70s for this, but it felt true to life, where she was so obviously disregarded as far as her opinions, and she's only a figurehead because her husband committed suicide. It shouldn't be her paper. All throughout the movie, in board meetings, in meeting with Bradley Whitford, and meeting with Tracy Letts different times, all men are trying to mansplain why she should do what she should do. And it's like this big...
This is mansplaining the movie. It should have been mansplaining.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And versus the mansplainers.
This podcast could actually be called Mansplaining the Episode, but... that's a great point. Everyone's trying to use her as a pawn when really she's the queen. And she has the final say, and she puts her fucking foot down in a greatly acted scene like you just talked about. I mean, it was nice to see. Yeah, it was on the nose, and it was on the nose chauvinism. But that existed, I would think, more so at that time as to now we're in more subtle, hidden chauvinism where you got to kind of look twice at it a little bit in certain cases.
I just thought if they could have pulled some of that off, it would have been more timely. And they just didn't have the time to do like a Jordan Peele level criticism.
Right.
You know?
I mean you're talking about a 2-hour runtime as is, right?
Exactly. And it's really too much for one movie, unfortunately. However, I love some of the deviations they make. I love the intern, you know, tracking down the Times headline. I love that, even though I hated the fact that he almost gets hit by a car, and the other little kid almost gets hit by a car. Why are we sending children through the streets of New York as a reliable courier?
Well, these weren't children. These were like college kids.
We think that's the way to take, you know, especially when you got all these goons at the doors. That's what we do. Is that what really happened, Steven Spielberg? Did you read that somewhere in one of the 10 hours of the Ken Burns documentary?
Well, I mean, they're not just kids. I guess the one kid getting given the papers to school.
I find they're 17, 18, yeah, whatever, but they're almost getting hit by traffic.
They're old enough to know that they shouldn't be hit by a car and to do what they can to avoid that.
Don't show them almost getting hit by traffic. Show them, like, you know, weaving in and out and being awesome at their, you know, their little job there. But anyway, that's one. I'm going to have a love-hate thing for a lot of this stuff, but I mentioned a lot of my love, and what did you love, Mike?
Yeah, my biggest love was not so much a scene, but it was the overarching. I mean, I'm a sucker for it, and I'm very political, and I try to keep that at arm's length from this podcast because nobody wants to hear about it. But the Tom Hanks, just his character in general, where he keeps saying, imploring how big a deal, you know, when there he finds out that the Times has the Pentagon, New York Times got the Pentagon Papers before the Washington Post did. The Washington Post is basically chasing the Times, and Tom Hanks makes that known throughout the movie. You have David Cross's character saying, come on, Ben, it's only one story that they beat us to, and Tom Hanks is saying, no, it's 7,000 pages detailing how the White House has been lying about the war in Vietnam for 30 goddamn years. Everything where
the way they lied,
the conversation he has with Kay to make it to hammer home the press and the political sphere can't lay in the same bed anymore. They have to be kept separate because the press has to be a check on the politician's power. All the stupid First Amendment my country tis of thee playing in the background while the American flag waves. I was a sucker for it throughout this movie because it was done by Tom Hanks in part, and I just loved all that.
I just wish he didn't have the whoosh in his hairdo.
I know you can't get past the wig. You can't get past the coif.
I mean, the voice is enough.
The way they lied.
You just like doing that voice.
I'm enjoying myself here.
Yeah, that was what about your worst scene? Your least favorite?
I hated several scenes in this movie.
Yeah, I did
and
too,
it's almost unforgivable with a movie with such highs, with such a well-dramatized arc of its protagonist, like the Liz Hannah story, like I said, the Meryl Streep role. I thought they did an awesome job with that. But the Tracy Letts post-meeting scene where he talks about the seven-day limit to declare a catastrophe, which is written in the bylaws of their newly signed
their contract,
newly consummated contract.
Because, again,
with the
context being the Post is being sold to this investment group who has not yet finalized the deal. And so all this could fall apart if Kay decides to publish the papers.
It's like the jinxiest jinx jinxer scene in the history of jinxy jinx scenes. It's the most ridiculously thing. It's like the...
I'm going to live forever.
Yeah, it's like the character... It's like Goose. It's like Goose yes. and freaking Top Gun, as that's where my brain just went now. And Meg Ryan, and then just saying, oh my goodness, we can't wait till you come home, honey. We're going to go on a trip around the world. Yeah. We're gonna have such a wonderful life ahead of us. And it's just like, of course, the exact thing's going to happen. And Meryl Streep just wide-mouthed in that scene. She doesn't do her best job, so I hated that scene. I mentioned the kids running through the streets of New York. That was annoying. All the Supreme Court stuff was bad to me.
That was my worst scene, that freaking clerk in the Supreme Court. Yeah, my brother's still over there. I hope you win.
And then her boss is just like a stomping evil
troll
monster.
I'm the bad guy, in case you didn't know.
I don't want your excuses.
Good God. Yeah, that was...
I mean, again, if you portray people with such an obvious light, you're going to start to piss them off.
Yeah.
And that just should touch nerves for us as critics. Never mind. I mean, we get on people for that type of portrayal and other stuff too. So that's just
don't
obvious
even bother.
Ham-handed
you don't
portrayal.
Even need that in the movie. It serves no purpose other than to hammer home that what they're doing is good. You just spent 2 hours explaining that.
Yeah, it's repetition. Sometimes that works. This case, it was just a poorly written, you know, little minor character. The scene when the old, bald, fat guy from Tenacious D with no personality or character arc comes out and says,
"Cancel Jack Black.
We won, and so does the Times." That was more emoting than that guy ever did. I don't know who he is. I don't know if he's an acclaimed thespian. I don't know if he's Spielberg's neighbor. But it was so anticlimactic for me. I
want him dead. I want his family dead.
I love Carrie Coon. You have the scene already being carried by Carrie Coon. She's on the freaking phone, and she could have easily. I mean, she's almost crying. She's saying what's happening. She's relaying it. Why isn't Carrie Coon carrying that scene? This is Hollywood preachiness and didacticism at its worst, and I just hated that that moment. It pissed me off so much. Streep also telling Hanks what the function of the press was at the very end.
Yeah.
After that movie
yeah.
magic.
Yeah.
I loved all the production of the newspaper stuff. Those montages were just like catnip to me. I was in awe all three times I saw it. I mean, the shots with the papers just on their conveyor belts, going up to the ceiling of the huge warehouse.
Putting the headline letters in.
The army of old fat white guys smoking something or other and putting on, you know, all the whatever thing. It reminded me of my school newspaper days. It was just, I loved it. It was a simpler time. It was so much fun to watch all their tinkering.
Men were men.
But no, they're tinkering with all that stuff. They're throwing the papers into the trucks. Yeah. All the trucks are delivering the papers to this. I mean, that was movie magic to me. And the problem is Streep just telling Hanks at the end, well, we just got to keep at it. We're going to be wrong a lot of the time, but we just got to keep at it. And we're not fake news.
She's not wrong. I mean,
it's not wrong. It's just not drama. It's not drama. It's not. And neither is, yes, we won. So did the New York Times.
But it's part of her role to also be the conscience for the audience and be like, look, I know I was the main character. My arc is done. But the purpose of the press isn't. The beat goes on.
Dude, I can hear that and read that on, you know, the news outlets I watch. I can hear that anywhere. I can hear that talking to you in a conversation. I don't have to pay $12 to $15 to go see an actor who's being paid, you know, millions of dollars say that on a big screen. They have to formulate it in a dramatic way.
Cut to Mike in the non-spoiler section saying he can listen to Meryl Streep read a shampoo bottle.
I had a hard time with that scene. No, you're right.
That's fair. Just to provide context of what happened at the end of the movie, obviously the case did go to the Supreme Court. It was the New York Times that went up against it. There was a big clash as to whether the Post should even publish these reports, not only because of the First Amendment issues, but because they happened to get them from the same source that Matthew Reese's character, that the Times got theirs, which would have opened up a whole door of legal issues. We could have ended up with Kay and Ben Bradley going to jail for collusion. They ended up going through the case. The New York Times went to court against the government. New York Times won. The Supreme Court ruled 6-3 in favor of freedom of the press, saying that the press is for the governed and not the governors, which is basically one of the big tentpoles that separates our country from a lot of others.
You could have ended the movie right there, and we would have all been
happy.
How
did you feel about the decision being read almost verbatim for a couple lines in the office?
It's fine because Carrie Coon is just a wonderful performer. And maybe Streep was phoning it in. I don't want to say that, but maybe she was at the last scene.
God.
Her and Hanks are just sitting there, you know.
Don't go to sleep tonight.
Her and Hanks are just sitting there after this awesome movie magic montage.
You gotta get a war full of critics and theater majors at your doorstep.
Listen, Luca Guadagnino said sometimes the best drama is simply truth. And I'm sorry, sometimes it's not. Guadagnino and Michael Stolberg's speech and him writing that speech and stating those great things.
I have not seen you.
I enjoyed that. But just attacking on at the end of the movie, oh, here's the theme again. It just pissed me off.
One last thing I want to before we go, before we wrap this up, we brought it up in the non-spoiler section. I want to make sure we address it. Sarah Paulson's role in this movie. We did touch on that in the non-spoiler section. She plays Ben Bradley's wife, Tony Bradley. She has lines in this movie. She doesn't have an arc. I mean, she's just basically a side character, an ancillary character. She does a lot as a wife she deals with her husband going off at all hours of the night because his job calls for it. She makes the sandwiches when there's a surprise gaggle of reporters coming over to go through the Pentagon papers in her home.
Yeah.
She's a very, you can tell she's a capable, strong woman on her own and is capable of making her own decisions and is fiercely independent in her own right.
Yes.
The difference is between her in this movie and someone like the secretary character in Darkest Hour. She's given a moment in this movie where she is able to shine as her own person.
She has agency. You're absolutely right. She's convincing Ben Bradley to have respect for Kay Graham.
Yes.
And to finally put his faith in Kay Graham to the level that he won't meddle with these bankers anymore. They'll simply call her up. He'll go along with the fact that Fritz Beebe's calling her up, and he'll trust in her to make the right decision. He won't try to overtake her in the argument and speak for her. And Tony Bradley does a lot to convince him of that. That's a great scene that builds.
I love
and
that scene, yeah.
Argues and bats the ball back and forth.
And it's a woman. It's a womanhood thing. It's one woman supporting another woman instead of tearing one down. It's illuminating just the magnitude of this decision for Kay on a personal level as a human being that she has to make, and it illuminates it more for Ben Bradley.
Honestly, if you structure on-the-nose dialogue in a back-and-forth where it's a scene that's clearly a negotiation, I mean, Mike Nichols always talks about there are negotiations, there are fights, and there are seductions. There's three types of scenes. That is clearly a negotiation where the wife is trying to give her husband a greater understanding and give him currency that he can use in further scenes. And it works because you're accomplishing that. You're going from negative to positive. You're working that scene like a true screenwriter should. That's probably a Liz Hannah scene, because I think Josh Singer was brought in and it kind of rushed it, and he did all the trimmings. And I
wish this movie did take its 2 or 3 months longer to and be in a 2018 summer release.
Yeah.
And just kind of gone for the Oscars next year, because I feel like, it, you know, all the potential in the world is there. How many more times in our life are we going to have Spielberg, Hanks, and Streep with this undercard of the Sarah Paulsons, the Bob Odenkirks supporting
it? I agree. It feels like a little bit of a missed opportunity. A couple things I wanted to point out from the real history before we go. The biggest revelation from the Pentagon Papers was ignored in this movie because it was too grim. I mean, the bombings of Cambodia, Laos, North Vietnam, that was a major escalation in the Vietnam conflict, unreported at the time, and really unreported in this movie. Was it just too gruesome for these guys to hit on it? We don't want to talk about the bombing of all these people.
I mean, we could guess about that. Why didn't Dunkirk, or The Darkest Hour for that matter, talk about all the civilian loss? You know, all those ships, all those civilian lives that they played heroes, but they also lost them along the way.
But we're shown mass carnage in Dunkirk.
Right.
So it's not like you're right. They kind of condensed that scene into more of a just they arrived at all together at one moment, which is like we talked about in the history is not what happened. But it definitely is convenient for a suspense movie to structure it that
way. It's possible to cut corn. I mean, it's possible to be on the nose. It's possible to cut corners. It's possible to have pertinent information missing and still put forward a decent movie.
It's a balancing act. There's no question about it. I did want to add one last final nugget here. Pointer.org and History.com have competing articles on this online. Listen, the Wikipedia page reads that the movie The Post de-emphasizes the New York Times involvement, like I said, exaggerating the Washington Post role. Times spokesman James Goodale even said in an interview for the Daily Beast that the film creates a false impression that The Post was a major player in such publication. It's as though Hollywood made a movie about the Times' triumphant role in Watergate.
Ironically is where the movie ends. The movie ends with the infamous phone calls, and I think someone's happening at the Watergate Hotel.
I like the Nixon phone calls, by the way. I like those scenes with the real phone calls of Nixon and the actor playing Nixon.
I like them in that Nixon's face was never shown.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you do it in that way, that's fine.
Judge Rehnquist really did make that phone call to the Post. He's now a Supreme Court judge.
Yeah.
Times critic, New York Times critic, Manola Dargis, awarded the Post a New York Times critics pick. So go figure. they still practice free journalism.
We're
over
all
there.
In this together. Little High School Musical for you. Final grades. Let's put a bow on this.
I have it a tier below my Academy Award considered movies. I have it as a B86, which is with a huge hogwash of other movies. I have a lot of 86s this year. So it's a deep bench of good movies, of watchable movies, of movies that are worthwhile. And I definitely recommend this one. I just don't think it's anywhere close to a top 10. And I just want to do some quick insider baseball that I forgot to talk about before. Tom Hanks is Tom Hanks in this movie. I love them. I love Tom Hanks, period.
But should he be a best actor?
He is not. a top 10 performance of the year for me. He is not better than Daniel Kaluuya. He is not better than Jake Gyllenhaal. He is not even close to Robert Pattinson, not even close to Chadwick Boseman. He's not in the ballpark of Hugh Jackman and Logan. I'm sorry. He is Tom Hanks in this movie. He is a movie star. He is awesome. He might be top 20, you know, after you get through the rarefied air performances of the year. But he is not a top 5 performance on the year. You people are crazy to put him there. There's no way. And if you scratch somebody out like a Gyllenhaal or like a Kaluuya, I mean, listen, Tom Hanks cannot be his part in this movie cannot be considered in the same realm as Denzel Washington's and Roman J. Israel Esquire. It's not even in the same ballpark. It's not even in the same category in my mind. And I love Tom Hanks. It's one of those where you just put a stamp on it. Well, Tom Hanks has had a great career. This is another just reliably good job. I loved his character. I love him as a movie star. I do not think in no way, shape, or form he is better than, you know, probably 15 other actors on the year.
Yeah, just off the top of your head, you know, you're the Chalamet's, James Franco. You have the exact same problem that I had with Emma Stone last year in La La Land. Yeah. Great performance. Good job. Love the character. You're playing yourself. And, you know, should you get the best actor? Are you getting the best actor or actress because you're put on a great performance? Are you getting it because everybody loves the movie, loves the subject matter, loves the cast?
That might be another problem for me, too, because I've seen All the President's Men like 50 times, legitimately yes, 50 times. And Jason Robards is... I mean, that performance is just so incredible. I mean, his voice cuts like a knife, and he carries the movie as the main kind of, you know, the antagonist. We talk about antagonism. Like, he's the main guy they got to convince as two reporters, Woodward and Bernstein, and they do it, and that's the end of the movie, essentially, where he says, okay, go to print, don't fuck it up, end of movie, right? That's such a great, great scene and such a great role for that character. So we've seen a lot of the Bradley-isms.
You're salivating.
Yeah, I love Jason Robards, period, but said Tom Hanks didn't try to do that, and that's fine.
No, I'm with you. I mean, I don't know that I would give him a nom. I can think of plenty of other from awards potential movies this year that are just more worthy. Jake Gyllenhaal, again, you said it, but I cannot believe he's got no momentum for his performance in Stronger, which I think is world leaps and bounds more than what Hanks put forward here. If he bumps Kaluuya, that'll be a travesty in its own right.
I've heard a lot of predictions that say Tom Hanks is a shoo-in and Kaluuya's falling out of it.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me.
Insane
that
to me.
Is dumb. That would be a bad move.
It's insane,
move.
But again, Tom Hanks, there's like 10 other guys before Tom Hanks this year.
Yeah. As far as grades, just to pick that back up.
Yeah, what did you think?
I told you last episode, he's taking this over.
I have people problems.
I gave it an 87. I'm a B+. I had enjoyment of the movie. It's wild to me that Darkest Hour, in that they're very similar in real life retellings with real people playing these real roles about these real government issues that happen. It's wild to me that Darkest Hour is seen as such the better film. I just don't see it. I mean, there are parallels to be drawn between the two. Do you go for Spielberg's handholding? Do you go for Joe Wright's bring your own ending with you, bring your own information with you? I don't see how this can be, how that movie can be seen as such a slam dunk winner, except for Best Actor, obviously, which we just touched on.
Honestly, I don't think either of them should be in the Best Picture of the Year conversation. That's just
if you're going to have one, I would put The Post in over Darkest Hour is where I'm going.
It's such an important movie. The subject matter, again, it's just something that we say amen to. Yeah. I mean, we believe it with every ounce of our being. My vote goes to Darkest Hour, but that's a good debate. I mean, there's so many highs in this movie that are on par. I would agree with Darkest Hour. For me, there's just not as many gaffes in Darkest Hour, so that's a little debate we can have. But there's gaffes in Darkest Hour, so it's a bit subjective because certain things bothered me, like the wigs in this movie, so I can't, like, begrudge you of that.
Right.
I just think, again, my expectations and movie-going expectations mean so much. That's why we begin every review with expectations.
I would be surprised,
right?
If everybody's expectations weren't falling short a little by this movie.
Too high, yeah. Because they're too high going in.
Yeah,
and you look at this
high.
Cast and you look at this filmmaker. And, yeah.
So that's going to do it for our Oscar sprint profile of The Post. What did you guys think? Did you see The Post? Do you think Tom Hanks is worthy of that Best Actor nomination, unlike Mike and I both do? Do you think Meryl Streep should have her name called for another nomination? What about your chances for Best Picture? How do you compare this to The Darkest Hour? Let us know all that. Any other thoughts, comments, concerns? How do you like these Oscar sprint profile series so far? What's your favorite for Best Picture? Tell us. Reach out to us. Let us know. Mike and Oscar on Instagram. Mike and Oscar on Facebook. MMO_pod on Twitter. Mike and Oscar at gmail.com. We're coming to the end of these. Oscar nominations are going to be out this coming Tuesday, the 23rd. We got the Phantom Thread left for the biggies to do. Might be doing a couple more after that, after we see the nominations.
We got some room in our schedule. Anything we've missed that actually gets a nod. I know we tried to cover all the most likely scenarios. Maybe we had the Star Wars movie event pod, and otherwise we got some fun stuff after the nominations are announced. We'll cover those nominations for sure, and we'll have fun with it.
Yeah, we're into this. We're in it to the end now. Oscars coming up. Oscar Sunday, March 4th. So we're, 7 weeks out? Something like that now? Man, we're right around the corner.
Coming fast.
So stick with us. We're going to get you as prepared as we can. Stay away from reality, because who needs that bullshit? Maybe that should be our new slogan.
Watch movies with us.
Reality sucks. Just watch movies with us.
Let's go to Schmapplebee's.
Catch you guys next time. Later.